What do you think is at stake in these public debates between faith and atheism?
Well, it's faith and reason. It's not atheism. What's at stake is reason and sound and sensible public policy, the willingness to abandon myth and superstition in favor of the universe as it really is. I don't think, the question is why do them? And there's not a lot of give and take in a situation like this, there's people who aren't going to, who want to come here to hear what they want to hear, and they'll hear what they want to hear. And so what you're trying to do is reach those people who've really never thought of the issue that deeply and encourage them to think for themselves and to be skeptical. In addition, I think it's important to call out distortion. And I mean, there are various people who have platforms, and Dr. Craig has a ministry, and in that ministry there's often things written in podcasts and other things that are, in my opinion, misinformation, distortion. And I think it's important to call that out and question that kind of credibility so that people will later on read skeptically or listen to things skeptically. Same with me. They should read everyone skeptically. But I think, for me, the main reason I do it is to encourage people to use reason and empirical evidence to guide their own actions and to encourage them to guide the actions of their public servants, their politicians. So what's at stake to me is a healthy democracy.
And so these culture wars, if I can call them that,
are serving a
purpose?
I don't know if they're serving a purpose. Religion is dying on its own, so I think that's going to, in the first world. And so whether this accelerates it or not, I'm not sure, but I think what it'll do is encourage people to think about how to appropriately replace the kind of things they get from religion with things that are related to the real world and not myths and fairy tales.
Mm-hmm. What do you think influences public opinion most? Is it the arguments, or is it the rhetoric, or are people simply being confirmed in their prejudices?
Well, I mean, rhetoric is very effective. That's why I refuse to have a debate, which is the normal format that Dr. Craig likes to do, and I've done with him before, because those are not information sessions, they're rhetoric. That's why I insist on having some kind of discussion, because even then, while the information flow is maybe limited, it's not as limited as a debate. But I think that what the problem is that people get religion thrust down their throats when they're children before they can think about it, and it's very, very difficult to break out of that. And so we've got to try and think of ways to encourage people. That involves seducing or provoking. And I think it's possible to do that and also demonstrating that my main goal is to demonstrate that the universe that we live in is so remarkable and amazing that you don't need to invent the myths and fairy tales. So I want to encourage people to be so amazed by the universe that they feel comfort in realizing how vast it is and not minding their own insignificance. In fact, finding at some level that also comforting. Mm-hmm. And so I think once one dispenses with the need to be the center of the universe, one can open one's mind to the remarkable things that we've learned in the last few hundred years, and those everyone should share.
What about the tension between serious argument versus the soundbite that seems so crucial to a Facebooked and Twitterized world?
Well, that's the problem in all cases. It's a general problem. One goes to events like this in principle because they're long enough that maybe there's some serious arguments. I'm not sure I've heard them yet, but in the two events we've had. But I think that the hope is that what I really think you do is at events like this and in writing, you don't educate people a lot. What you do is you motivate them to think and read. So you can't, in a 15-minute discussion of a general issue, you can't do that justice. And so even in a forum like this, you can't get people to learn. What you can do is motivate them to read and think. And so that's what I really want to do, is motivate them to question, to go out and to be skeptical, and then to read, and if something interests them, to go and read more about it. And the only place they're really going to get the serious arguments is if they spend the time sitting, reading, and thinking. And that doesn't happen in a forum like this, and it doesn't happen on TV or in radio.
But a forum like this could provoke people.
Yeah, as you can do in TV and radio.
Yeah.
And as I do in a classroom. I don't think most of the learning is done in a classroom. Most of the learning is done outside of the classroom.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of those... those scientists who are serious scientists but also serious believers in one sort or another.
Well, I have a lot of friends who are that way, and I think the point is that people can believe diametrically opposed things at the same time. We're hardwired to be able to do it. We all do that. As I like to say, we all believe 10 impossible things before breakfast in order to get up in the morning, and I could list them, but I mean, just to get through the day. And so I think what happens is that people, you know, belief is ingrained, and often, unfortunately, in my opinion, when you're a child, I think it's child abuse, but it's very hard to overcome. And I think that what happens is that scientists who have a strong belief just put it aside when they're scientists, when they're doing their science. As a very famous biologist once said, that, you know, when he goes in the laboratory, he's an atheist because he doesn't think anyone's twisting the dials and, you know, rigging the experiments. And then, as he put it, therefore, he might as well be one outside the laboratory. But I think the serious scientists say, look, the science, you know, I'm going to be guided by what the science tells me about the natural world, but I won't let it infringe on this belief I have about an imaginary guy in the sky. And it's just a characteristic of humans that we can all do that.
So there is a fundamental conflict between faith and science? Well, how would
between,
you describe
not faith, between religion, between organized religion and science. I mean, science is not incompatible with the idea there's some vague purpose to the universe, although there's no evidence of it. What science is incompatible with is all the world's major religions, the scriptures of which disagree manifestly with the results of science. So Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all of those are, from a scientific perspective, nonsense. And so science, there's no fundamental contradiction to the idea that there may be purpose. There's just no evidence of it. But what is disingenuous is to argue that somehow science is consistent with the organized religions, and those people who subscribe to those organized religions manage some way to balance their beliefs, usually by picking and choosing from the scriptures what they like and throwing out the stuff they don't like.
So you could conceivably be a scientist and a deist of some sort, but in a vague sort of way?
And you could be, as I said, you can be a scientist and a Christian, but you have to do that, you have to suspend your disbelief, or in fact suspend the disagreement, or throw out those, or be a Christian in name only, in the sense of saying, I believe I'm a Christian, but I don't believe this and this, don't believe in the virgin birth, don't believe in that and this and that. And so that's possible too, but I think it's certainly possible to be a scientist and a vague deist, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the main point is that God is irrelevant. People seem to think it's an important question. It's not an important question to scientists. Never comes up in public, in science meetings. Never, not once. Because, you know, God isn't necessary to discuss the universe. And so the issue never comes up. And as my friend Steven Weinberg, who's an atheist, a Nobel Prize winning physicist, has said, that most scientists don't think enough about God to even know if they're atheists.
So what is the role, if any, of Christianity, of faiths in an increasingly secularized world?
Well, it gets in the way. I think the role is to slowly, I mean, the role right now is to argue, I mean, the positive role is to claim to argue that the charity, goodwill, et cetera, et cetera. But I think ultimately, the other role is to provide some sense of community and support for people. There's no doubt that organized religion does that for people. And so it would be disingenuous, and or it would just be wrong to argue that it doesn't do that. The point is, do you need religion to do that? And I think the answer is no. But right now, I think the best role that Christianity can play is to support systems, and things that, you know, try to bring people together, and then get out of the way.
So going on from there, and you know, the obvious questions, what resources does atheist naturalism bring in terms of offering ultimate meanings, moral foundations?
Well, I mean, you know, again, you've sugarcoated the phrase, or you've weighted it when you call it atheist naturalism. If you mean scientific empiricism, rational thought combined with empirical inquiry, which is the way we learn about the world, what that does is bring much more meaning and spiritual wonder than religion ever does. Because, you know, the awe and the actual things we've discovered about the universe, the awe and wonder of the real universe, is spiritual in my mind, every bit as spiritual, in fact, more spiritual than the bland and boring and wrong stories in the Bible. But it has the great benefit of also being true. And so I think science can enhance your not only your appreciation of your place in the cosmos, but your awe and wonder. And of course, provide a much sounder moral framework for determining what's right and wrong than religion. And so
How does it
belong? I mean, so, you know, religion has usurped all as a, has taken apparent, you know, claims that religion is the source of morality. Well, if it is, it's an awful source of morality because the morality of the Bible is miserable. And if you look at, I mean, religious morality has traditionally been wrong. And what science does is based on, you know, you determining what right and wrong by reason. And I imagine, and I claim that almost everyone in the audience, regardless of their religious persuasion, really determines what's right and wrong, not because of the Ten Commandments or because of the thought they might go to hell, but because they don't, they, because of the reason. And if they stop believing in God, they wouldn't kill their neighbors the next day.
How can you tease that out more? How does science provide those moral foundations?
Well, first of all, you can't make a decision about what to do unless you know the implications of your actions. Mm-hmm. What your actions do. Science tells you that. Mm-hmm. Science tells you what the implications of your actions are. So that's the sort of thing. Then you also use empirical evidence and rationality to say, to try and assess the consequences. Mm-hmm. And also the past, you know, what past actions have done, and try and determine reasonably how a group of people who are thrust in a society can live in a way in maximum harmony, where each person can have their optimal expression and reach the best they can be as an adult. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt, if you look at the morality in the modern world, it's based on science, it's not based on religion. I mean, then getting away from slavery and women as chattel and all the rest, and hatred of gays, all of that's going away because science is telling us, you know what, you can't base your morality on some claimed 2,000-year-old book where they didn't even know the Earth orbited the sun, where they say, you know, gays are evil, when in fact all species have you know, all mammals have homosexual fractions in them, and there's nothing unnatural mm-hmm. about it. Once you understand the biology, then you learn that stuff is nonsense, and it allows you to make a more informed, ethical, or if you wish, moral decision.
Mm-hmm. Does anything unsettle your atheist convictions?
What do you mean atheist convictions? My convictions are, look, if there's empirical evidence for something, then I'm willing to accept that fact, and I guide my actions based on reason and empirical evidence, and nothing is going to unsettle that because that works. I'm not going to walk out the 10th floor window of my hotel because I want to get to the ground quicker. Well, and expect I'm going to do it and survive. So, I mean, I'm not going to throw a ball up and pray for it to, let a ball go and pray for it to fall up instead of down. That's just nonsense. It's just like going out in the rain and saying, well, I don't need an umbrella and I can just will myself to stay dry. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you talk about atheist convictions, if you're talking about convictions that physical effects have physical causes, I can make predictions, I can test them. The ones that don't work are wrong. The ones that do work have some possibility of being right.
I guess I'm talking about your conviction that there is no God.
Who said it? Did I ever say that in this interview?
No, you didn't.
What I said is that it's clear that a belief in the God of the world's great religions is not reasonable. Mm-hmm. And that conviction is just based on evidence and reason. And so, yeah, I've been asked at one of the events what would change my mind. And if I looked up tonight, if the sky's clear and the stars rearrange themselves to say in Aramaic or Hebrew or English, as I said in I think Brisbane, because some Americans say that God speaks English. If I looked up and I saw it rearrange, the stars rearrange themselves and saying, I'm here, well, that'd be worth thinking about. But as there's been no single shred of empirical evidence for any deity or any divine intervention in the history of the universe, as long as that's the case, there's no reason to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to young people these days who find themselves wrestling with questions of meaning, questions of science, questions of faith in a culture that offers them a lot of different answers?
Well, to be skeptical, to ask questions, to try and support the evidence that supports their convictions, but also find out, but be willing to challenge it and be willing to change your mind, and to force their beliefs to conform to the evidence of reality, because ultimately that will produce rational actions and a better future for them and for all the people around them.
William Lane Craig said almost the same thing.
Well, good. I'm glad he's listening to me.
Of the people from the opposite camp, if I can put it that way, on the world stage at least in these debates, who do you respect the most?
I don't label people. I don't label myself an atheist. There's some people I label by as Craig labels himself. I have good friends who I have great respect for as individuals and scientists who are religious, if you wish. Francis Collins, who's head of the National Institute of Health, is a religious guy. I think his religious views are nutty, but as an individual, I enjoy him, and as a scientist, I certainly respect him. I take everyone as an individual, so I try not to put people in camps. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I've learned from my old friend Christopher Hitchens, who was the most tolerant person I've ever known in terms of enjoying discussions with people whose views are people that I could not probably stand to be in the same room with.
Mm-hmm.
So tolerance.
Is there a danger for a physicist wading into the depths of philosophy and theology?
No, because there are no depths of philosophy and theology. They're very shallow. I don't wade into philosophy and theology. You don't need to. That's the whole point. You don't need to know anything about theology or anything about philosophy to do physics or to understand the universe. So so there's this claim you're philosophically naive, and it's just ridiculous, because once you disagree with the fundamental premise, you don't have to worry about the details. I don't wade into the alien abduction literature either, because I don't need to.
Don't you enjoy the X-Files?
Well, of course I do. I enjoy the X-Files, and I'll quote from them, but I don't need to wade into the history and all the details and the 1947 abduction of this person or that person, because from a fundamental perspective, as I often like to say, my mantra is from the old publisher of the New York Times, I like to keep an open mind, but not so open that my brains fall out.
Mm-hmm.
But this claim, philosophy is at one level. Theology hasn't provided any, as I've said many times, hasn't provided any knowledge to the human species in at least the past 500 years, so it doesn't have to, it can be completely discounted. Philosophy is, the critical thinking associated with philosophy is useful, but you don't need it. You don't need to read, no scientists read philosophers. No, essentially. It's not. But you certainly don't have to know anything that's going on in philosophy to understand the universe. The physical universe, and you may, like any reading, you may learn things and get and reflect upon yourself. That's true for literature and anything else. But it doesn't. But I don't have to read Moby Dick to understand the universe. I may get more insight into myself and like all good literature. But science does that too. But so philosophy, like any intellectual inquiry, has that inherent potential utility. But as a generator of knowledge, it doesn't. You reflect on the knowledge generated. Science generates knowledge, and philosophy critically reflects on it and often, illuminates the issues. That's all.
Mm-hmm. Last question. What do you make of Jesus?
I'm willing to accept that he existed. I like this new, the idea that certainly he was, led a group that was pretty revolutionary at the time, and no doubt deified him after the fact. The interesting question to me is whether he believed he was God or not. And if he did, as I often say, we have places for people like that nowadays. He would have met a much better end now than then. He would have been able to tell people he was God in a nice, safe room in a hospital. I see him as obviously an important historical figure, in the same sense that Muhammad was, and in the same sense, but there are other historical figures that were historically important, like Adolf Hitler, but they had an impact on the human race. I don't view him any more profoundly than anyone else. In fact, I despise the notion that if you don't believe in him, you go to hell. Anyone who says that is not worth listening to.
Mm-hmm.